the details of one of the parts of our proof of finiteness of class groups. So we'll give a complete proof in class that class groups of number fields are finite, but to get an explicit computable bound that sort of not only gives you sort of finiteness of the class group, but effective finiteness of the class group in the sense that you could compute the class group, it's necessary to do a little more work, and that's what the exercise does. But again, most of the details are given there, and it's really all basically calculus, so it's the sort of thing that probably you sort of people are really good at. Okay, so what we'll do today is we'll finish off chapter 7 on discriminants and norms, and then we'll get started on chapter 8, which is proof of the finiteness of class groups, and hopefully we'll finish that by the end of the week. And as usual, for those who came in late, the homework is the last page of the handout for today. Okay, so let's start at the top of page 74 in the notes from last time on discriminants. And there I mentioned that in Magma, yet again, the discriminant of a field gives you the discriminant of the polynomial used to define the field, not the discriminant of the ring of integers. And there's an example. Whereas in Perry, the discriminant gives you the discriminant of the ring of integers. And in this class, whenever I say, for example, d sub k, that's by definition the discriminant of the ring of integers of the number field. So there's a proposition, I think we proved this in class, but correct me if I'm wrong, which is that, and this is important for the first homework problem, if you consider an order O in the ring of integers OK, then the discriminant of the order is equal to the discriminant of the ring of integers times the index of the order squared. So, did I prove this last time? I don't think I did, but I think I did.
You might have.
I think I proved something closely related, at least, if I didn't prove this.
No, you proved this.
Okay, good. So, the point's just that you can view O as a lattice in OK, and so the discriminant was the volume of a lattice, and when you pass to a sublattice, that multiplies the volume by the, so the discriminant is the square of the volume of a lattice, just to give you a heuristic why this is true. The discriminant is the square of the volume of a lattice, where that volume could be a squared of a, I mean, well, it's not exactly that, but up to sine is the square of the volume of a lattice, and it's exactly the square of the determinant of a matrix that you get by taking a basis for the lattice that corresponds to OK. So it's the determinant of a matrix that corresponds to OK squared. And this is the same, but instead of A, it's C times A, where C times A gives a basis for O. And these determinants differ by a factor of det C squared, and this index is by definition det C. So the discriminant changes by the square of the index. So that's proposition 724. By the way, at this point, we now have enough to give an algorithm for computing O sub k. Before, I had mentioned that given a prime p, you could compute a p-maximal order. And then if you added together lots of p-maximal orders, you would get the maximal order, which is OK. But how do you know when you're done? Well, now there's a way to know when we're done. You apply this result. So suppose you have suppose you want to compute OK. So what you can do is first find an order in OK. For example, if K is Q adjoint alpha and alpha is an algebraic integer, consider the order Z adjoint alpha. So inside of OK you have the order O equals Z adjoint alpha. And And you can compute the discriminant of O. It's just the discriminant of the minimal polynomial of alpha, or it's the discriminant from this definition from before. And you find that the discriminant of O, you'll find it as a number, and you know from this proposition that the discriminant of O is the discriminant of the OK that you don't know yet, the ring of integers which you don't yet know, times the square of the index. So, if you compute the discriminant of O and factor it, then the only primes that could possibly divide this index have the property that their square divides the discriminant of O. So it's not an if and only if, but it's an if. If P divides the index of O in OK, then P squared divides the discriminant of O. So if you do the following, 1, you choose an O, such as this one. 2, you compute its discriminant. So far you've done nothing difficult. 3, you find the primes whose square divides the discriminant. That's extraordinarily difficult in general, but possible. And then for each of those primes P, you find a P maximal order. The sum of those P maximal orders will be OK. So the sum of P maximal orders, where P squared divides the discriminant of the O that we start with, this has to equal OK, where this means a P maximal order. So in order to compute OK, what you can do is factor the discriminant, find which primes have the property of their square divides it, and then try to decide whether or not the O that you have is p-maximal, and if it's not, use the algorithm that I described to get a bigger O that is p-maximal by, you know, iterating the algorithm that I described. And that will give you the full ring of integers. That's how a computer started. And by far the hardest step of all in this whole thing is factoring this. So the question of finding P such that P squared divides the discriminant is the hardest step. It's kind of weird because if you have a polynomial and you want to find the irreducible factors of the polynomial whose square divides the polynomial, it's very easy. You just take the GCD of the polynomial with its derivative. But if you want to find the squares that divide an integer, that's, as far as we know, extremely difficult. By the way, you don't need a really, if you just want an algorithm and you don't care too much about how fast it is, you don't need this sort of complicated algorithm for finding a P maximal order. Once you do this, you get a bound on the index. Call this, so you just take the square free part of the discriminant and divide that out, and then you get a bound on the index of O and OK, and you know that OK, if that bound is n, then you know that OK is contained in 1 over n times O. So you could run through all subgroups of 1 over n times O modulo O. There are finitely many of such subgroups, and one of them will be OK. And then you could discover that fact somehow. That would be an extremely bad way to compute the ring of integers, but it would work. Yes?
Just a question. How difficult is it in general to know whether Z adjoin alpha is an order in OK if you don't know the ring of integers?
All you have to know in order to know that it's an order, so an order just means finite index. So let's suppose that this, that K has degree n as a number field.
Oh, okay.
Then this is z to the n as an abstract abelian group.
So A is a root of a polynomial
with
degree n.
Yeah. Yeah. All you have to do is decide whether the minimal polynomial has degree n. Yes. Okay, so let's do an example. Okay, first let's compute the ring of integers of Q adjoin root 5 with proof. So here we'll take Z adjoin root 5. That's an order. And its discriminant, so we'll obtain the discriminant as the determinant of the trace pairing matrix. And the trace pairing matrix Well, let's take a basis which is 1 and root 5. And then we take and multiply together 1 times 1 and take the trace, which is 2. 1 times root 5 and take the trace, which is 0. So it's a trace of 0, right? Because it's root 5 plus minus root 5, which is 0. And then what goes here? 0. It's symmetric because it's just multiplication. And then here you have what? 10, right? 10. Okay, so it's 20. And this is 2 squared times 5. So you know 5 definitely divides the discriminant of OK, and it might be that 2 divides this index. So maybe 2 divides the index. And motivated by that, you consider instead z 1 plus root 5 over 2. And this is the maximal order, because its discriminant is the original discriminant, but divided by 4. So discriminant of this one, when you write down the matrix, it's so first 1, I'm sorry, 2, 0, So the basis I'm using is 1 plus root 5 over 2. So now 1 times 1 plus root 5 over 2, that's 1 plus root 5 over 2, and that has trace 1. And then the square of this, what's the trace of the square of this?
The square is 3 plus 0.5 over 2.
Okay. Which has trace 3. And then this determinant is 6 minus 1, which is 5. Since no square divides that, this is definitely, provably, the maximal order. It's the ring of integers. Because if it were an order that wasn't the maximal order, then you'd have a square that divides, namely the square of the index. So the fact that this is 5 implies that OK is equal to z 1 plus root 5 over 2. There's another example in the notes, which is Q adjoint cube root of 2. And Q adjoint cube root of 2, it has an order in it, which is z adjoint cube root of 2. And the discriminant of this order is, so you end up computing the determinant of a matrix with a bunch of zeros, a 3, a 6, and a 6, and it has determinant 2 squared times 3 cubed. So from this you can deduce that 3 definitely divides the true discriminant, the discriminant of OK, and it's possible, just from this, that either 2 or 3 could divide the index of O in OK. So you only have to check at 2 and 3, but if you show that this order is 2 maximal and 3 maximal, you'll conclude that this is the full ring of integers. And in fact, that is the case. You can show that this is 2 maximal and 3 maximal. So in fact, O is 2 and 3 maximal. And that implies that O is equal to OK. But the point of this discriminant business is just to reduce computing the maximal order to, or the ring of integers to, a finite amount of computation. And there's something called Dedekind's criterion, which I mentioned before, which allows you for a given prime P to decide whether or not O is maximal at that prime. Or you can use the algorithm that I described, which is more complicated. Okay, so the last part that we'll do is about norms of ideals, and this is really totally crucial to how we'll prove that class groups are finite. So I'll introduce a notion of norm of an ideal and prove that it has certain properties, and then what we'll do is show that the way the proof of finiteness of a class group will go is as follows. One will assert that there are finitely many integral ideals of bounded norm. If you give a bound B, there are only finitely many integral ideals of norm up to B. Second, we'll show that if you have any integral ideal at all, then it's equivalent in the class group to an integral ideal of norm less than B. Therefore, the set of equivalence classes that make up the class group has to be finite. So that's the structure of the proof. And showing that any ideal is equivalent in the class group to something of bounded norm, that will use something called Blitzfeld's lemma, which is a it's basically an assertion about the intersection of a lattice and a bounded symmetric convex domain in R to the n. Okay, so now let's set up the basic theory of norms for ideals. Okay, first here's a definition. If you have two lattices L and M in a vector space V, then the lattice index L colon M, this is something that makes sense even if M is not contained in L, is the absolute value of the determinant of any matrix A, where A of L is equal to M. A sends L onto M. So A is an automorphism of this vector space V, and it sends L onto M. So that's the lattice index. And just to check that it seems reasonable, let's take a really simple example. Let's say L is 2z, and M is 10z, and these are both lattices inside of R, R1, and then the lattice index, L colon M, the absolute value of the determinant of a 1x1 matrix that sends the first lattice to the second one. So you can take the 1x1 matrix whose entry is 5, and that does it, and that has determinant 5. And notice that really is the index of 10z inside of 2z. So this is something that, when m is contained in L, it agrees with the usual index, but it makes sense even more generally. For example, let's switch this. Instead of considering the lattice index in this direction, it could go in the other direction, m colon L, and then these are the same. But then the matrix, what matrix sends M onto L?
1/5.
1/5. The 1x1 matrix with entry 1/5, which has determinant 1/5, sends M onto L. So we have a lattice index now. It works both ways, and it extends the usual notion of the index of one group in another group. But it has nice properties. For example, if you have three random lattices inside of V, then you have a multiplicativity property. So I'll take these in a second. Okay, so if you have lattices L, M, and capital N inside of V, then you have L colon N, the lattice index of N and L, is equal to L M times M N. So that's really nice. And notice that there's no condition at all about L containing N or M being contained between them. You have this in total generality. You can also, so you can you define the lattice index this way. By the way, you can view it as just a usual index that you might be used to as follows. L and M are both contained in some common lattice, namely take their sum, L plus M. That's a lattice that contains both of them. And then there should be a formula in terms of usual lattice index, in terms of usual indexes. And I think it's, let's see, you can get it from that thing I wrote down over there. So L, M is, so first I'll write it like this, like you're suggesting, using L plus M. Okay, notice that the index on the right, that's a usual index. It's just the index of one lattice inside of a bigger lattice. And this index isn't a usual index, but this is equal to, if you switch these around to get something that's a usual index, it just changes it by inverting it. So this is equal to L plus M colon M, that index, divided by L plus M colon L. So this is the quotient of two usual indexes. Each of these is just the cardinality of the quotient. And you take the quotient of these two. And that's the lattice index of M and L. So I'm just showing you that you can express it in terms of usual indexes. Take a common lattice that contains both of them, and then we get the definition that way. But you can think about it more directly like this. And so that's the lattice index. And I think this doesn't really require proof. It's just the fact that determinants are multiplicative on matrices. And you also have, as I mentioned a couple of times already, that if M is contained in L, so here, if M is contained in L, then the lattice index L colon M, it's simply the cardinality of L mod M. And that's just the fact that that's just a property of determinants. And you could see this, for example, using Smith normal form on the first day of class. Okay, so now we have a nice way of associating a number to an ideal, to any fractional ideal in OK. You just take the lattice index of that fractional ideal in OK. They're both lattices in K, and the lattice index is a number, a rational number. Now the goal is to prove that this norm has nice properties. So the definition, if you have an ideal, fractional ideal then its norm of I, this is the index in OK, the lattice index OK colon I, and this is a non-zero rational, it's a positive rational group. Okay, so it's a nice clean definition. And now, what kind of properties do we want this norm to have? So, one property is that if, this is just immediate from what I've written already, if I is an integral ideal, then the norm of I is the cardinality of the ring OK mod I. Because if it's integral, it means it's contained in OK, and the norm is the index, which is by definition the cardinality. So for example, if I were a prime ideal, then OK mod I would be a power of that prime, of the integer prime that is contained in your prime ideal. So that's one property. And this just follows immediately from this fact right here. Another property is that if I is any fractional ideal, and alpha is in K, non-zero, then this one's a little more interesting to prove, then the norm of alpha times I is equal to the norm of alpha in the sense of norms from, you know, norm k over q of alpha times the norm of the ideal I. Okay, so for this one, I'll work a little bit harder. And here's the proof. So this is just a multiplicativity, and it's the sort of thing you might expect, but remember, this is the norm as an element of the field, so there's something maybe going on here. But here's how you get it. So you write this norm
norm of, so proof, the norm of alpha times I is by definition the index in OK of alpha times I. Now the trick is to rewrite this as the index in OK of I times something else, using the statement at the top of the board. Okay, so I'll rewrite it as the index in OK of I times I colon alpha I. And we've basically done it, except the order's backwards over here, but OK colon I, that's the second factor, and I colon I alpha, I, the index of alpha I in I, what's that? So the trick here is that the definition of the lattice index is it's the determinant of an automorphism that sends the first thing onto the second thing. And left multiplication by alpha is such an automorphism, right? So we can use, in the definition of index, the determinant of left multiplication by alpha, which is exactly what we defined this norm to be right here. So this is the determinant of left multiplication by alpha, which is this norm. So you have that these are equal as well. Okay? So that's the second thing. And now the third thing, which is slightly deeper, is that the norm is multiplicative. So the third fact is that the norm is multiplicative. So if you have any fractional ideals at all, norm of I times j is norm I times norm j. So remember, we can write any fractional ideal as alpha times an integral ideal. And we know that you can always multiply out the alpha because of this equality here. Also, the norm of, well, yeah, because of this. So it suffices to prove this for integral ideals. So proof and. This is easy when I and j are coprime. It's just the Chinese remainder theorem from the first part. The Chinese remainder theorem says that if I and j are coprime, then the cardinality, well, you have that OK mod ij is isomorphic to OK mod I, direct sum OK mod j. This is in the case when I and j are coprime. So you have this Chinese remainder theorem isomorphism. And this certainly tells you that the cardinality of this finite set on the left-hand side, which is this norm, is the product of the two cardinalities on the right-hand side. So it's easy when I and j are coprime. But what if they're not? When they're not coprime, you don't have a decomposition like this. It's just not true. So what are you going to do? So there, we'll use, so if I and j not coprime, we're going to use that we determine the structure of OK mod P to the N. So we did this at some point. We found an isomorphism between, what we did was we determined the structure of P to the N mod P to the, we determined the structure of, for example, P mod P squared mod P cubed, and so on. And from that, you can deduce the structure of this, or at least its cardinality. So. Okay, so in the case when they're not coprime, you can quickly reduce to the case when I and j are both prime powers of the same prime, because you write I as a product of primes and j as a product of primes, and if you could show that you have this multiplicativity whenever you have a product of, whenever you have a product of two of the same prime with itself, then you would get it for everything. Because when you have different primes, you certainly get it. So all you need to do is show that you have multiplicity for the same primes, and then you get it. So assume that I is P to the N, and J is P to the N. Okay? Now what we have to show is that, so what we want is that OK mod P to the N plus M has the same cardinality as, so the question is, how are these related? as OK mod P to the n times the cardinality of OK mod P to the m. So if we show these have the same cardinality, they'll be set. And the way you show this is by showing that OK mod P to the n has cardinality, the cardinality of OK mod P to the power of n. So this is what I'll show. If I could show this, then on the left-hand side, you'd have the cardinality of OK mod P to the power of n plus m. And on the right-hand side, you'd have the cardinality of OK mod P to the power of n, and the cardinality of OK mod P, the whole thing, to the power of m, and then you would have equality. So I'll take this, and I'll go to the other blackboard and show you why this is true. Okay, so recall P to the n mod P to the n plus 1 is isomorphic non-canonically as an OK module to OK mod P. And we check this using, we used CRT and a careful construction to make an isomorphism. We chose an element that was in P to the n plus 1 but not in P to the n, and then we inverted it in a careful way, careful to keep track of what we were doing, and we got an isomorphism like this. That was totally non-canonical, but it's there. Consequently, this quotient has the same order as this. Now you make a filtration on OK. P squared all the way down to P to the n. So this is a filtration. It's a collection of subgroups such that it's a collection of subgroups that get bigger and bigger. It's a tower of subgroups. And the neat thing is you know what each of the quotients are in cardinality. So we'll just go down to P to the n. What you have is that OK mod P to the n, if you successively apply over and over again the various isomorphisms theorems you learn right at the beginning of a class in ring theory, then you find that this cardinality is the same as the, you're just viewing everything as OK modules, this cardinality is the same as the cardinality of P to the n minus 1 mod P to the n times the cardinality of P to the n minus 2 mod P to the n minus 1 times, and so on, all the way down to the cardinality of OK mod P. So you just look at this, each time the quotient, the successive quotients, they're all they're these things, the cardinality of all the successive quotients is the same as the cardinality of the big thing. So then this is, now we know what the cardinalities of each of these are. The first cardinality is the cardinality of OK mod P by what we proved using Chinese remainder. And the next cardinality is, by the same argument, OK mod P, and so on all the way down the line, you have a whole bunch of copies of OK mod P in cardinality. So the cardinality of this is equal to the cardinality of OK mod P to the n, but this is just cardinality of OK mod P raised to the power of n, which is exactly what I needed to show. So as a group, OK mod P to the n is certainly not isomorphic to OK mod P to the power of n, but its cardinality is the same. It's just like saying Z mod 9Z isn't isomorphic to Z mod 3 cross Z mod 3, but they have the same cardinality. Okay, so we now know that norms, the norm function on ideals is multiplicative for any ideals at all. There's no requirement that they be coprime or anything like that. Okay, the very last thing to do in this chapter is that there are only finitely many ideals, integral ideals of bounded norm. And this will be, it's easy to prove, but it's also crucial for proof of finiteness of the class group. So now, finitely many ideals of bounded norm. So we have a number field k, we have the ring of integers ok. We consider, and suppose we fix an integer b, then the following sets finite, the set of ideals I in OK, such that the norm of I is less than or equal to B.
This is finite. And the reason is, you just think about what this condition means, that the norm is less than or equal to b. It means that OK mod I, or the cardinality of, or this index is less than or equal to b, of course. And that means that, it means the index of I and OK is, well, it is that the index of I and OK is less than or equal to b. But that means that this implies that I is contained in 1 over b times OK. And the reason for that is the following. If you take the quotient OK mod I, it's a finite group. This has an abelian group, it's a finite group. And it has its cardinality. Actually, what I just said is wrong. But yeah, this is wrong. We'll still be able to prove it, but this isn't the right group if you give an n. So this is a finite abelian group of cardinality less than or equal to b. So if you take, for example, it's annihilated by some integer, where that integer, say the order of this, is less than or equal to b. So let's say that this is killed by some number that's less than or equal to b. So let me let n be, the least common multiple of the integer, to be very inefficient, the least common multiple of the integers up to b. And certainly n times this is equal to 0. And that means that I, n times OK, is contained in I. So OK, I is contained in. Okay, n times OK is contained in I.
What do you mean? N is contained in OK.
Yeah. Well. Actually, I mean N OK is contained in I. So.
You want to say OK is contained in 1 over N?
Yeah. That's exactly what I want. I think, well, I'm going to bound the possibilities for I. And I guess, actually, this is enough. N OK is contained in I. So what is I? I mean, I is contained in OK, and it contains N OK. And how many? See, OK mod NOK is a finite set, so there's only finitely many possibilities for an I that's contained between these two. So, OK mod NOK finite implies finitely many possibilities for I.
Did that you just mod everything by NOK?
Yeah, yeah. You can think of it that way. The ideals with this property are a subset of the ideal, are in bijection with a subset of the ideals of OK mod N. And OK mod N is a finite ring, so only finitely many ideals. But there's a slight mistake in what I had sort of started to write down before, which is just because this group has order less than or equal to B doesn't mean that B kills it. For example, Z mod 7 has order less than or equal to 8, but it's not killed by 8. So I don't know if I did that in my notes. If I did, it's wrong. Oh, I didn't say what n is, so. Yeah. Okay, so now we're on to finiteness of the class group. Okay, any questions about discriminants or norms of ideals? Discriminants or norms of ideals? Okay, so now class groups. So
see how far we can get.
And as a reminder, the midterm will be next Tuesday. I'll give it to you on Tuesday, and then you'll give it back to me on Thursday. And this homework assignment is quite shorter in the sense that it has only two problems, but they're long problems, so and take that with a grain of salt. But the length is partly an indication of the number of hints. So, all right, so on to the class group.
So start with the number field k, and then inside of it you have its ring of integers O sub k, and then you have the class group C sub k, and this is by definition the group of fractional ideals. We prove that's a group. Wasn't easy, but we prove that the group of fractional ideals is a group. Modulo the principal fractional ideals. So you take all fractional ideals,
then you quotient out by the ones that are generated by some element of some non-zero element of k, then you get a group, and that quotient group is called C sub k. That's the class group of the number field k. Okay, any questions about the definition?
Okay, so you can already start asking some questions about this. Notice one thing, if the class group is trivial, if and only if every ideal, every fractional ideal is principal, which is the same as every ideal being principal in the ring of integers. So this is, observation, Ck is trivial if and only if the ring OK is a principal ideal domain.
So, for example, a Z-adjoint I is an example of a PID, as we'll prove in a minute. Are there infinitely many k's so that CK so that OK is a principal ideal domain? Does anybody know?
No, we don't know.
Okay, you read the notes.
No,
you don't know.
I don't know.
Yeah, we don't know. That's a major open problem in number 3. Just to prove that there are infinitely many k, so that OK is a PID, we don't know the answer. Well, the conjecture is yes. In fact, if you just look at quadratic fields, it looks like there's some sort of heuristic reason why there should be infinitely many already with just quadratic fields. But we don't know a construction even in general. And there are very surprising theorems like... There's a very surprising thing. It's so surprising, I haven't read the proof, and I'm not sure I believe it, but if you take abelian extensions, as the degree goes up, the probability that the class group will be trivial becomes higher and higher. So, very strange. If you take all abelian extensions at a given degree, you have a good chance that they'll have trivial class group eventually. Very strange. I don't know if I believe it, but yes, I read that somewhere. But in any case, we don't know whether or not this happens infinitely often. If anybody here can find a way to understand that, we'll be very famous. So, is the cardinality of the set of fields K, so CK is 1, is this infinite? And of course the answer is yes, but the question is, prove it. So I'll write it that way. Prove this cardinality is infinite. So one reason to be interested in class groups is that there are open basic problems in number theory about them that you can understand a statement of, such that if you solve them, you get eternal fame and glory. So, and there are many other questions about these things. Another question that has a very famous history and was only resolved in the mid-50s, really, is the question, if you take quadratic imaginary fields, A equals cubic join root minus d, or d positive and square free, say. Which of these, if you just look at this set of fields, which of these have class number 1? So it was proved at some point that there are only finitely many. And there's a list of 9 that you can write down pretty quickly, which do have class number 1. Gauss wrote them down. And he conjectured that was it, that there aren't any other ones. It was a theorem for a long time that there is at most 1 more. But eventually, several people showed that list of 9 is, in fact, the complete list. So the first person to show it and have people believe that his proof is correct was Harold Stark. Complete list. So first was Harold Stark. Actually, a German named Huebner proved this before Stark did, and unfortunately, Huebner didn't write things up very clearly, and he was a high school teacher, and the combination of these two things meant that nobody believed his proof, even though it was completely correct, in the sense that if you worked at it hard enough, you could find a nice way of thinking about it, that it was actually right. When Stark found out that Huebner had already proved his PhD thesis, he was a little bit disturbed, to put it mildly. He told me that he was supposed to talk at the big national AMS meetings, and he found out about a week or two before his talk that Huebner, he had went through Huebner's proof and realized that Huebner had really proved this statement, classifying all of the quadratic imaginary fields of class number one, for which CK is trivial. So, complete list, I should be a little clear, complete list of K with CK equal to one for K quadratic imaginary. So he said he was very nervous, you know, he's just this young guy, and he had to talk in front of thousands of people about some major result and say that, in fact, he wasn't the first person to prove it. And, you know, some guy that mathematicians had ignored for some time had actually done it before him. By the way, there's an undergrad here named Zeno Tselkov who's doing his senior thesis right now with Richard Taylor, and it's on a really nice, clean way of thinking about what Huebner originally did. So if you want to find out how Huebner did this, the thing to do is to read Zeno Tselkov's senior thesis when it's done. So the zeroth person was Huebner, but the thing you should look at is Zeno's senior thesis. There's also a guy named Alan Baker who I think also proved this result by yet another method. So by the way, the complete list of quadratic imaginary fields with which are PIDs is given at the very kind of near the bottom on page 83. So the discriminants of those fields are -3, -4, -7, -8, -11, -19, -43, -67, and -163.
It's supposed to be square free.
So this D in defining it is square free, but the discriminant itself need not be square free.
Right.
For example, the discriminant of Z of Q adjoint I, that's -4. So actually, let's do that right now. So if you take Z adjoint I, take Q adjoint I, the ring of integers is Z adjoint I, and the discriminant of that. So this D is not necessarily the discriminant. So the discriminant of Z adjoint I, you get that by taking the absolute value of the determinant of the matrix, which is the trace pairing matrix where you use this basis. So 1, the trace is 2. Here the trace is 0, 0, and I squared is -1, so you get -2, right? And so you get -4 as the discriminant. So not to be misleading, but this D here, I didn't mean this to be the discriminant. Sorry. And actually, on the previous page, I've made a table of the real quadratic fields with class number 1 up to 1,000. And notice that there's a huge list. And it doesn't look like a list that's going to suddenly stop. But it's an open problem to prove that, you know, generating this list doesn't stop. All right, so now on to proof of finiteness of the class group. So just for fun, let me write down an exact sequence before stating finiteness. So you have this the ring of integers, you have the number field, you have this class group defined as a quotient of two things. It's kind of nice to write down an exact sequence that puts all this together. And here's an exact sequence. So I'll use the notation div OK for the group of fractional ideals. It's the divisors on the primes of OK. Remember, the fractional ideals, they're the same thing as the free abelian group on the primes, and the divisors on a set, really it's the divisors on the set of maximal ideals of OK, but that's the free abelian group on the primes. So that's a reasonable notation to use. So you have an exact sequence that ends with the class group, and then it has
The thing that maps to it is the divisors on OK, the group of fractional ideals. And the thing that is the kernel, the thing you're questioning out by, is the principal fractional ideals, which, let's see, so there's a map from K star to there. And its kernel, what is the kernel of this map? It's the units, OK star. Those are the elements of K star that when you consider the corresponding ideal, you just get the unit ideal. So maybe I'll put a 1 here. So this is an exact sequence. So the kernel is the image of K star, and the ideals that are the principal fractional ideals that are just trivial are the principal fractional ideals generated by a unit. And in fact, you'll see similar exact sequences if you start thinking about algebraic curves over finite fields. Actually, the whole theory is very similar there. OK, finally, proof of the finiteness of the cross group. First statement of the theorem. And this theorem isn't just that the cross group is finite. It gives all kinds of other nice corollaries. For example, we'll prove that if you take any ring of integers of any number field, its discriminant is not equal to 1, except for Q. That will follow almost immediately from this theorem. OK, so a theorem, this is theorem 812. And it's the following. So you take a number field K, and let's let R and S denote the number of real and pairs of complex conjugate embeddings. So for example, so what are R and S for Q adjoint I?
1 equals 0 is equals 2. By 1.
1, right. R equals 0, S equals 1. In general, R plus 2S is equal to the degree of the extension. So that's K.
So
now,
what exactly do you mean by the number of real embeddings?
Those are the number of distinct ways of embedding the field K into the real numbers. In this case, there's no way to do it. So another way to think about this is, suppose you have an alpha that generates K as an extension of Q. Then take its minimal polynomial. R is the number of real roots of that polynomial, and S is the number of pairs of complex conjugate roots, because each of the roots gives an embedding. So another example, what about Q adjoint cube root of 2? What is R and what is S?
1 and 1.
Right, 1 and 1. There's one real embedding and one pair of complex conjugate embeddings. Notice that 1 plus 2 times 1 sums up to 3. All right, so here's the thing. Then there's a constant CRS, so it's some real number, such that such that every integral ideal class, well, every integral ideal I is equivalent in the class group, equivalent in CK to an ideal with norm to an integral ideal. It's important to emphasize an integral ideal with norm less than or equal to the square root of the absolute value of the discriminant of the field times this constant CRS, which depends only on R and S.
that doesn't depend on k at all.
Doesn't depend on k at all. The only dependence on k in this bound is in the, appears in the discriminant, nowhere else. So you can work out this constant once and for all for a given R and S. There's an optimal value. If you vary over all fields with a given R and S, there's an optimal value of this constant. And if you knew it, then you could use it in this theorem, and it gives you kind of a better bound. Now here's your homework. Your second homework problem is to prove that one can take the CRS to be... So in fact, there's a, for any R and S, you can take CRS to equal square root of the CRS is equal to 4 over pi to the power of s times n factorial over n to the n. So the only dependence on r here is in the n. Remember, n is equal to r plus 2s. So this is it. This will work for any field at all whose signature is r comma s. And that will be your homework problem. Now, I won't prove in class that this bound works. That's your homework problem. But I will prove there's some CRS. If you take a set with certain properties, then its volume will give you this. So I'll prove finiteness of the class group, but I won't only do it so precisely. Okay, so step back and think about what this says. It says that there's this, given a field, there's the specific number, B, and every single element of the class group is represented by something that's an integral ideal of norm at most B. So the class group is finite. Moreover, you could compute it. If you were to just list all the elements of norm up to B, and then find the relations between them, somehow find a minimal list, then you would have a class group. You could find the multiplication table. In fact, let's try it. Let's compute some class groups using this theorem. So we'll do two examples. One is Q adjoin I, and the other is Q adjoin square root of 10. So Q adjoin I, we better show that the class group is 1, and for Q adjoin square root of 10, well, you'll see what happens. So I'm going to give two examples of how to apply the theorem to compute class groups, and then prove the theorem, except I might run out of time. But we'll definitely prove the theorem this week. The first example is K equals Q adjoin R. Okay, and we figured out that R is 0 and S is equal to 1. So let's figure out what this number is. By the way, this number is called the Minkowski bound. So let's figure out what the Minkowski bound is for this particular field. So we computed the discriminant just a moment ago, and it's minus 4. We know R and we know S, and N is the degree of the extension, which is 2. So we just plug that in, and you get, So it's minus 4, the discriminant, times 4 over pi to the power of S, which is 1, times 2 factorial over 2 to the power of 2.
Don't you want the square root of the...
Yes, I want the square root, otherwise it's going to be wrong. And thank you. So it's not the discriminant, it's the square root of the opposite value of this, which is 2. So this number is 2 times 4 over pi times 1/2. And the 2's cancel, so it's 4 over pi, and 4 over pi is less than 2, because 4 is less than 2 times pi, since 2 times pi is bigger than 6. So the conclusion is that any ideal is equivalent to an ideal of norm less than 2. The only ideal of norm less than 2 is the unit ideal of norm 1. Therefore, the class group of... Therefore, once we have this theorem, we'll see that the class group of Q adjoin I is trivial. Well, this is yet another way to prove that Z adjoin I is a principal ideal domain. All right, next let's do a more random example, Q adjoin square root of 2. So this one will have kind of more ideas and more interest, because here the bound won't be as good,
and we'll have to work harder to see what the class group is. By the way, there are algorithms that are implemented in Magma, for example, or Perry, that compute these class groups for you. Compute, you know, generators, compute the relations, tell you whether two things are equivalent. They're reasonably fast, but even using kind of the best state of the art algorithms, if your number field has degree 40 and the coefficients that define it are at all large, then you're completely out of luck, and it will be, unless you know some really special properties of your field, you probably won't be able to compute anything about the class group. So it's a very difficult problem to compute these class groups once the number field has degree too large. But for small degrees, it works really well. Okay, so let's do our next example, which is Q join square root of 10. This is some real quadratic field. And if you look at the list at the end of the notes of real quadratic fields of class number 1, you'll find that this one isn't in it. So this one has discriminant 40. And you see that 40 is not in the list on page 82. So let's see. To show that it has discriminant 40, we need to find the ring of integers. So OK is, it's going to be z adjoined root 10. And I'm not going to do that. So this is, in fact, true. If you compute the discriminant, here you find that it's 40. And to prove this is the full ring of integers, you just have to show it's 2 maximal, and you can do that. Something you can do. Okay, so assuming that, we have n equals 2, the degree of the extension, r is equal to
2,
right? And s is 0. And now let's figure out what Minkowski's bound is. So the Minkowski bound is right here, square root of 40 times 4 over pi to the power of s, fortunately s is 0, times n factorial over n to the n. So here you get 2 root
squared.
Oops. What?
It should be 2 squared.
Yeah, you're right. Okay, so this is 2 root 5. No, it's 2 root 10 times 1 half. So this is root 10. And root 10 is less than, certainly less than 4, but it's greater than 3. So the bound we get, every ideal is equivalent to an ideal of norm at most 3. So now we have to figure out what are all the ideals of norm at most 3. And we can do that. So ideals of norm less than or equal to 3 is every element of the class group is represented by one of these ideals. So here's how we'll figure out what the ideals of norm less than or equal to 3 are. We'll take the integer, we'll figure out all the ideals of norm 1. That's just the unit ideal. So, unit ideal. This is the only one of norm 1. Next, let's figure out all ideals of norm 2. So, a way to try to get an ideal of norm 2 would be to take the integer 2 and then factor it. And the prime ideals that divide it have a chance of having norm 2. They're going to have either norm 2 or 4. So, let's factor 2 OK in this field extension. And I think I do that in the notes. So, oh yeah, so it stays prime. Well, we can check that, but 2 OK is prime. And OK equals z root 10. Okay, and the reason for that is that, let's see. That seems weird.
Is it ramified?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't believe it's prime. I think I'm wrong. And you're right, because it divides the discriminant, it's ramified. So this is just wrong, which is exciting. Okay, so in the middle of page 78, they claim is wrong, this is not true, 2ok is in fact equal to the square of the time. Okay, now we have to figure out what that is explicitly. It's going to be 2 and then something squared. What?
10.
Okay, let's see. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, and then 2ok mod that is just.
Yeah, that
yeah,
works.
Two elements.
Yeah, and the reason this works is because if you quotient out by this, remember you're quotienting the ring z adjoined root 10 out, so if you mod out by 2 and root 10, you end up with z mod 2z. So this really is a prime ideal, and it certainly contains 2, so you have this, and it's ramified, so you have to have this shape. So 2 root 10 is a possibility. Is it possible that this ideal is principal? So if it were principal, so is it possible that P is principal? If it were, then there would be something of norm 2. There would be a specific element of norm 2. And you can see whether or not that's the case by looking at the general form of the norm equation. So if P, this is the P line over 2, if P is the ideal generated by alpha, then, and this is sort of tricky, this constantly, then the norm of P2, which is 2, would have to be the norm from k down to q of this integral element alpha. But what's the norm look like? So a generic element is a plus b root 10, and it has norm equal to, just writing everything out, a plus b root 10 times a minus b root 10, which is a squared minus b by minus 10b squared. And can this possibly equal 2? So working mod 4,
if you work mod 8,
or let's see.
Yeah, if you do it mod 8, it doesn't work.
Okay, so we'll work mod 8. So we want to know if there are integer solutions to this. So considering it mod 8, then you have a squared, so minus 10 mod 8 is 6. So that's plus 6b squared mod 8. And the squares of integers mod 8 are 0, 1, 0, and 1.
Just 0, 1,
and 4.
And 4. 2 squared is 4. And now you just have to try the possibilities and see if you get 2. So the question is
6
is this
plus 4.
0, and 4.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah.
So 6 plus 4. Hey, okay, so that doesn't rule it out. Mod 8 does not rule it out.
Mod 10, it doesn't work either, actually.
Yeah,
mod 10. How do you get it mod 10?
Because
how do you get 2 mod 10?
Yeah, you don't get 2 mod 10.
Oh, you don't get 2 mod 10. Okay, so
you don't get 2 mod 5, I guess.
Yeah, that's good. Mod 5. The squares mod 5 are 1 and 4. And okay, so work mod 4. I mean, work mod 5. So mod 5. Mod 5, this is a squared period, mod 5. Hey, what are the squares mod 5? 0, 1, and 4, and none of those are 2. So you don't get 2 as a square mod 5. Therefore, this has no solution. There's no way that you can do this. So this is not principal. So we've now found a non-trivial element of the class group. So 2 has lying over the prime ideal generated by 2 and root 10, and this gives a non-trivial element of the class group. Also, oh, did you have a helpful remark? Not helpful.
We just proved that root 10 was irrational, equivalently. Huh.
Yeah.
So, another observation.
That's it. You need to know that. You're right. Okay, so can you say anything about the order of the element 2 comma root 10 as an element of the class group? What is its order as an element of that group? 2. Because it's non-trivial, and if you square it, you get a principal ideal. So this is a non-trivial element of CK, and it has order 2. Of order 2. So we now know that CK, it's a group, and it has an element of order 2 in it. And we'd be done, except for the pesky fact that the Minkowski bound isn't quite good enough. It says that every ideal in the class group is equivalent to something of norm at most 3. So now I have to worry. What if there's something of norm 3 that is not equivalent to this thing? What if this group is even bigger than order 2? Maybe it has order 4 or something, and you have some elements of order 3. Okay? So you have to worry about that. So now let's worry about that by finding the ideals of norm 3. So if you had an ideal I, the integral ideal of norm 3, well, let's suppose it's prime factorization. First, if it were a single prime, then that would mean that the norm of the prime ideal would be 3. But if you write I as, you know, P1 to E1 dot dot PR to ER, then you have that the product of those primes, norm of P1 to the power of E1 dot dot norm of PR to the ER, that this is 3. And each of these are prime integers bigger than 1. So all the EIs have to be 1, and you have only a single prime. So if you have an ideal, an integral ideal of norm 3, then that integral ideal is a single prime ideal, where that prime ideal has norm 3. In fact, that works for any prime P. There's nothing special about 3 in the argument I just gave. So that implies that I equals a prime. This is completely general, it's not just for 3, or for quadratic extensions. So now we want to find, I mean, it's completely general in the sense it works for any prime integer. Doesn't work for any integer at all. If this were 9 or something, then the argument would be different. So now we have to find the prime ideals of OK that have norm 3. And that's the same as, hopefully, well, in this case it'll turn out it's the same as the primes line over 3. And whatever it is, it's always a subset of the primes line over 3. So we have to factor 3 times OK. So fortunately, we can do that using the factorization of x squared minus 10 mod 3. So we want to factor 3 OK. And we can use our algorithm because we have a monogenic ring of integers. So factor, I'm going to find 3 OK. That's what? So we take x squared minus 10 mod 3. The factorization of that polynomial will give us the factorization of our ideal. So how does this factor modulo 3? Are there any
x plus 1.
Okay, great. Because you reduce 10 mod 3, you get x squared minus 1, which long ago you would be x minus 1 times x plus 1 mod 3. So that tells us that our ideal is, each of the ideals are the ideal, so the ideals line over 3 are the ideal generated by 3 and root 10 minus 1, and 3 and root 10 plus 1. So these are two additional prime ideals, which I'll now call I'll call them Q1 and Q2. And we now know that the class group has the property that every element of the class group is equivalent to either the unit ideal, to this particular ideal, or one of those two ideals. And the problem is, what is the structure of this class group? So given the mistake in my notes, we have to wing it a little bit. What I know must be true is that these are equivalent to this one over here. In the notes, I prove that these two are equivalent to each other, but that they're non-trivial. So first, let's check that they're non-trivial. So Q1, the class of Q1 in CK is not trivial. And the argument is just as before, we have to check that there's no element of norm 3, and that will prove that the thing is not principal. It's pretty easy to prove something is not principal. So we look at the equation a squared minus 10 b squared. We have the wrong equation.
Yeah, I have the wrong equation in my notes too. Okay, so look at this equation, and let's ask, is there a solution to a squared minus 10b squared in integers, a squared minus 10b squared equals 3? And,
four.
4, 5.
5 works again.
Okay, so mod 5, you know, the a squared would have to be 3, but the squares mod 5 are 0, 1, and 4. So that works. So this does not have a solution by working mod 5. Therefore, neither of these ideals are principal. But if you, fortunately I chose different generators in here, but so so these are equivalent in the class group. So you can find a way to multiply this one to get to this one. So there are easily seen to be equivalent generators just by changing the first entry mod 3 in the notes. So there I chose 3 and 2 plus root 10 and 3 and 4 plus root 10. And then I got lucky. I divided one generator by the other one, and I amazingly noticed that if you take the quotient of these generators that involve root 10, you get this thing, 1/3 1 plus root 10. And the fun thing is if you multiply the first ideal by, yeah, if you multiply the first ideal by alpha, then you get the second ideal. And there's no requirement that the thing you multiply by be integral. In fact, it wouldn't work then. But if you multiply the first ideal by alpha, you get the second one. So let's check that. So I'll take the ideal generated by 3 and 2 plus root 10, completely equivalent generators. All I've done is change the second entry by subtracting off or adding 3. And here I change the second entry by adding 3. So if you change, if you multiply this by alpha, by 1/3 1 plus root 10, then the first product is 3 times 1/3 1 plus root 10, which is 1 plus root 10. And the second one, by how we cook this up, it's the product of these two. Alpha is 4 plus root 10 over 2 root 10. So if you multiply this alpha by 2 plus root 10, you get 4 plus root 10. And this product has, well, it's an integral ideal, and you can easily change it to get to the second one, 3 comma 10, or root 10 plus 1. So you have the root 10 plus 1 here, and yeah, just if you subtract the 2, you get 3 here. So this is 1 plus root 10 and 3. Good. So this calculation I just did shows that these two ideals are equivalent in the class group. Q1 is equivalent to Q2 in the class group. Now, to finish the proof, what we need to show, since these are non-trivial, to finish is we need to show that 2 root 10 is equivalent to both of these, or to any one of the two. Yes?
You can just say that the class group has order at most 3 and it has an element of order 2. So
how do you know? Yeah, you're right. Yeah, I like that.
Mm. So it must be easy.
Has order at most 3 because these two are equivalent. So every single thing must be equivalent to either 1, 2 root 10, or one of the two, fix one of the two. So Q1 has to be equivalent to one of these three. And it has an element of order 2, so it's a group of order at most 3 that has an element of order 2. Very good. So it's a group of order 2. Yes?
If you computed the norm of Q1 inverse, Q2,
yes.
It
yes.
would be 1, right?
Yes, that's correct. Definitely.
Then would it be
by multiplicativity.
Yeah, then would it
be? Because, well, I'm just verifying what you said. You take the norm of Q1 inverse, what is the norm of Q2, then that has to be the norm of, wait, Q1 inverse. Yeah. So the norm of Q1 is the same as the norm of Q2. So this is norm of Q2 inverse times Q2. This is 1. So yes, this is equal to 1. That's
so
what you're asking.
Does it follow that the fractional ideal Q1 inverse Q2 is okay.
How do you know that Q1 inverse and Q2 inverse have the same norm?
Because they both have norm 3. Because you can just see by pushing out that they both have norm 3. I think that... Yeah, it's a good idea, I think. That actually works. So you're totally right.
I'm just trying to...
I like the thought. So if you take Q1 inverse Q2...
It has norm 1.
Then this has norm 1, so this is trivial in the class group. So this has norm 1, therefore it the product in the class group is equal to 1. And that means that Q1 is equal to Q2.
Yes,
that's a very nice argument. Mm-hmm. Nice script, but I think that's right.
But it has norm 1 in the class group, but we don't know that it's an integral ideal, right? It could be like some other ideal times an element.
But if you have an ideal of norm 1, that means that it's equal to OK, because the definition of norm is the index of the thing in OK. So if you have I and norm of I, if you have a fractional ideal and norm of I is equal to 1, that means that this index is equal to 1, which means that there's an there's an isomorphism, something of determinant 1 that sends I to OK, so it has to be...
It has to be okay because we have factorization.
Actually, I have to think about that. You might be right. It could be something funny here. But it may not be integral. Okay, but we have to go, so anyone else to go, go ahead. But I'll continue to talk about this. I think you might be right. I think that I might be messing up. But I might think about it personally.
I mean, otherwise you're saying any two things are the same.
Yeah, I think it's just
that. That's true.
I think what you have the Q1 times Q2 is trivial in a class group, but I don't think you have the other way. So I think that I'm just being dumb at the end of the class. This does not imply that these two are equal. It just implies there's an automorphism that sends one to the other, which...
Is it fractional ideal? Do you want inverse Q2?
Well, no, it does, actually. It has two prime divisors, which are Q1 inverse and Q2.
Oh, yeah.
Those are the prime, that's the prime factorization. So I'm completely wrong. That argument does not work. I'm completely wrong at the end. That argument doesn't work.
Last
thanks for suggesting.
Most three out.
But the problem set. All your problem sets are available. All of your problem sets are available. You can put them in
here. And then you have the best guy. And then I can't have any others.
The problem is that there's just OK plus I is not. Just because that's equal to 1 doesn't mean at all that. So here's the problem sets right here.
The problem is that it's still true that Q1 that
well,
I
so
is the same norm.
How do you know?
No, absolutely not true. That was just wrong. And here's why you can see that these aren't going to be equal. This, you take I to be Q2 inverse times Q2 times, take I to be Q1 inverse times Q2. That has norm 1. But its unique factorization is Q1 inverse Q2. These are different functions. So it's really not unified. Because if you have unique factorization, you multiply two different factors together. So it's not true. If all you have is that if you take the product of all the primes lying over something, that is one in the class. So you do get a relationship.
It does. It does. I just couldn't.
Nice.
Oh, Mary.